You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hey, this is Bob, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast was recorded on Thursday, right before reports that Biden had warned Netanyahu that there would be consequences if Israel didn't improve the humanitarian situation in Gaza, and before reports that this warning had led Israel to open a new aid corridor to Gaza. Now, we'll have to wait and see how significant this does or doesn't turn out to be, and the same holds for reports that Biden told Bibi he wants a ceasefire very soon. I haven't seen reports that anyone in the administration is warning about withholding military aid to Israel, and I suspect that the administration is a long way from really using that kind of leverage. Still, this latest round of news has led to more conversation about that possibility. So, since we begin this podcast by discussing Biden's failure to use that leverage, or any kind of real leverage, I just wanted to let you know what information was and wasn't at our disposal. Anyway, pretty much everything we say is still relevant. In fact, a lot of it is actually more relevant by virtue of these recent developments. And I think it's a very good discussion. And if you like it, I encourage you to smash the like button or share this on social media or rate and review the podcast or do whatever it is you do when you like things. Okay, so here's my conversation with Derek Davison and Daniel Besner. Oh, look, it's the guys from the American Prestige podcast who have stumbled into the Non-Zero podcast, or else it's the other way around.
No, I think we've stumbled into yours. I think that's fair.
Well, thank you.
You're the podcasting godfather, the guru.
Oh, we
worship
too kind.
At your feet.
You're too kind. But keep
that's
it up.
That's true. I always think you should be up there. Like, they always point to like Bill Simmons and Mark Maron and Adam Carolla. I'm like, no, dog, it's Bob Wright. Bob Wright is the initiator.
I was podcasting when they were gleams in their father's eyes.
That's exactly, exactly.
Reflecting off their millions
you
of dollars.
You blazed the trail.
Right, yeah. I don't know what went wrong if I had first mover advantage, but I don't know how I wound up hanging out with guys like you.
First
you
mover know? Disadvantage, it turns out, in this case.
Apparently. So, a lot happening in foreign policy.
That is true.
I would have thought that if ever there was a week when one might hope, however naively, that Joe Biden might seriously consider suspending weapons shipments to Israel, this would be it. And I'm not just talking about the strike on the aid workers, you know, but also the strike on the Iranian generals in Syria, which I thought was kind of underplayed, maybe partly because of the strike on the aid workers, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly less visceral. You have to make that argument about sovereignty and embassies, right? So, or like,
wait,
what is...
Can I just say one thing about that?
Yeah, for sure.
Yes. Like, yeah, the New York Times did this thing like, well, is it or isn't it a violation of international law to, you know, to hit an embassy? Because after all, the explicit international law about embassies is mainly about the host country not attacking right. the embassy. Well, that's possibly because that law started evolving back before there were airplanes. You didn't have to worry about any other country attacking. But that aside, it's a violation of international law to kill anyone in Syria because the Syrian government didn't give you permission. But we've become so accustomed to these strikes by Israel and Syria, and for that matter, to America striking whoever the hell they feel like striking, that, like, you know, that goes without notice, that it clearly is a violation of international law.
Syria is a non-country at this point, right? I mean, as far as the United States is concerned, as far as Israel's concerned, they just do what they want. I mean,
it's a playground.
The U.S. is
yeah.
squatting on a third of the country with no permission from anybody just because we're doing it. Because who's going to stop us?
Yep. So anyway, I interrupted you, Danny. Should we introduce ourselves? You're Danny Besner.
I'm Danny Besner.
Derek Davison.
There's Bob Wright.
Yeah, I wasn't making any sort of brilliant point. I was just saying that I think it's less immediately resonant because it there's like a second step of understanding why this is a bigger deal than it might seem at first. And the aid workers is obviously such a brutal thing to have happened to people who are trying to do well. It's much more emotionally visceral, I think, to most people. But it, I agree in terms of, you know, if historians were looking at this in 10 years, they'd be like, oh, yeah, this was a big week for the aid workers, but also for this strike on Iranian territory, at least technically.
Yeah. I think it's, and I mean, I know the answer. I mean, it's obvious why, but I think we should still maybe sit with it for a minute. The fact that the strike on the aid workers, as horrific as it was and as intentional as it seems to have been, has elicited vastly more outrage than the deaths of thousands of children, the starvation of at least dozens of children at this point. The deaths in among those among the thousands of civilians who have been killed in Gaza, scores of other aid workers have been among those deaths, but they've been Palestinians. So, you know, obviously that's the reason why this elicits so much outrage, including from Joe Biden, who, you know, maybe we can talk about that New Yorker interview with Aaron David Miller and Joe Biden's stark lack of empathy for Palestinians. But you know, it's I still think we should sort of absorb that for a second, like why that's happening or the fact that it's happening when nobody to this point at least the top levels of this government seems to have cared all that much about the vast number of dead people in Gaza to date.
Well, there have been the ritual expressions of concern and regret from the administration. And was this any more than a ritual expression of concern and regret from the, I mean, it seems like they just kind of keep it in step with what they perceive to be the public level of outrage. Right. I mean, yeah, Biden gets as outraged as the average you know, Democrat or something.
Right. And I mean, even that's, I think, illustrative, but yeah, I mean, I do think there's this, the statement that Biden put out was, I mean, you remember, Bob, when he put out that statement marking, you know, I can't remember what he was marking at this point, but it was marking some number of days since the start of the conflict. And it was all about the Israelis who died on, who were killed on October 7th. It said nothing about the Palestinians and people were angry about that. And now, you know, this statement that he put out about the aid workers is much more emotional, visceral. We're talking about, it's all rhetorical, obviously, because they're not doing anything to change the policy, but we're talking about him being outraged and in just using terms that have never been used before in reference to what's happening.
Yeah. Although I are there any signs of that translating into anything concrete? Like,
no, none. I mean, they've said as much, like, this isn't going to change anything. And I mean, you know, you had John Kirby the other day saying, not only, you know, do we not think this was an intentional war crime, we don't think the Israelis have ever committed a war crime or have not, at least since October 7th. We have no indication that they've committed any war crimes, which is crazy, even under normal circumstances. If we weren't watching them commit war crimes regularly, it's impossible to think that you could be doing what they've been doing for 6 months and not have done it. It slipped a little once, but not according to the Biden administration.
Well, you know, there was this piece in 972 about the way you featured this in your newsletter, I think, the way they've been using, Israel's been using this right. AI thing called Lavender, a little euphemistic, for compiling kill lists.
Smidge.
And this shouldn't be confused with an earlier 972 piece about some different AI they were using called the Gospel a couple of months ago, because what that did, that AI targeted buildings that were likely being used for military purposes. This focuses on individuals, and it assigns a probability that they are militants based on their observed behavior. And then it focuses on killing them wherever they are, and them being at home sleeping with their families is not considered a deterrent. In fact, one person was quoted as saying that's preferred because...
Right. Not only is it not a deterrent, that's what they... according to the piece, that's their preferred place to go because they feel certain that they will get the target that they're aiming for. They're also going to kill the family. They're also going to kill anybody in surrounding buildings. But, you know, that doesn't matter, apparently.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I want to just be clear. The reason the Iran thing concerns me is that, I mean, this was a major escalation. I mean, along a number of dimensions, three Iranian generals, including a very important one on Syrian soil and apparently within the diplomatic compound of the Iranians. I mean, you just can't invite retaliation any more robustly than that. And of course, Iran, contrary to stereotype, is actually a very careful and rational actor, and they will calibrate the retaliation as they did after the killing of Soleimani, in hopes of not starting a war. But this does increase by some number of percentage points the chances of the U.S. getting sucked into a war, even if it's just from like 5 to 7% or something. And what I'd like to know is, did Israel clear this with the U.S.? Because if not, that is 100% unacceptable. Like, you know, I mean, just in terms of like textbook relations between superpower and nominal client state, you don't do that. And I don't know. Am I the only person like getting upset about this?
No, I mean, you're absolutely correct. Derek, there hasn't been any information about that, right? The intelligence communications or the military communications between them, right?
No, I don't so think we have so. No idea. I, think, yeah. I mean, the Biden administration has said they had nothing to do with it, which if you take that at face value for, you know, if you're inclined to do that, suggests that they didn't even know about it, that they...
Yeah,
that,
but who knows? I mean, they lie done, so
but,
often. Right.
But
yeah.
That's an indictment of its own kind about yes. Right. About this relationship between the U.S. and Israel. If they
yeah, it's very strange. I mean, again, it's just this is why, Bob, we've always talked about this, but you really got to focus on what's going on at home if you want to restrict the empire. It's just gotten to a point where it just allows anything to happen because there's just no, well, it'll be interesting to see if there actually are domestic consequences in this particular case in November to be decided. But I think it just indicates like if the people of a country aren't actually directly suffering from what their country is aiding and abetting abroad, people just don't really care that much as a general rule. This is why the uncommitted thing is actually quite interesting. If Biden loses to Trump, I do think it would be difficult not to see a Democratic Party shift on its policy toward Israel. But if he doesn't lose, then I think we're just going to get more of the same.
Yeah, I will say I've revised. I don't know if you remember, it was 2 or 4 months ago when we did one of these. And Danny, you said that if Biden's handling of this is blamed for his loss, that could have an impact on American politics. And I kind of dismissed that because I said his loss is going to be overdetermined. There's going to be so many things at work. But I will say that as this has played out, I think it's more likely that there will be that kind of conspicuous legacy of this whole thing. And there will, you know, it'll have an impact. The impact of this on the election may have an enduring impact on American opinion.
It's all about, I mean, just to borrow Bob Jervis, right? It's all about perceptions. So who is doing the perceiving in this case? And it would basically be DNC party elites or Democratic DNC elites and Democratic Party elites. And, you know, in their circles, certainly people do care about Israel and Gaza. So, you know, even if the election is overdetermined due to economic whatever factors, it'll seem to them that it has to do with Gaza, or it'll seem to them that it'll have to do with international relations. So I think that's why you might actually see a shift in it. And then, you know, leave it to the historians to determine why exactly something proceeded as it did. But I think it will be perceived as having affected Biden's loss should he lose.
I mean, the poll numbers are getting worse and worse for him on this issue. The number of Americans.
Yeah, on this issue, he doesn't look, he's very old. Trump is also very old, but Trump has a vitalism, right? So there's a lot of things, I think, pushing against Biden beyond just this one. But I think this one has a resonance in the people who, you know, determine political strategy.
He looks like a loser. I mean, he looks like he's getting rolled because he is probably every day by Benjamin Netanyahu. And you can't. That's regardless of the specifics of the issue or the policy, it just makes him look ineffectual, like a doddering old man.
Well, because that's what
going
he is,
into
right?
an election. He is, but
yeah, I mean, this is the problem, right?
At some point, feeds like... that. I mean, it all feeds into that narrative, and you know,
he is a very old, obviously not extremely well man. It's just at some point your lying eyes aren't going to deceive you any longer. This is common sense interpretation of how he literally acts in the world. I don't care about the State of the Union speech, which, by the way, also wasn't that like dynamic as people were claiming in the day after. So it's just like I've used this term a lot, but it's all kayfabe. And this is, you know, not a good way to run a political candidate. It's also a good way to make you feel nuts.
I'm less convinced that there's going to be any change. What I think is going to happen if he loses is you're going to see the Democratic establishment do this incredible two-step where on the one hand, they blame everybody who's been pissed off over the Biden administration's policy on Gaza for causing the defeat. And at the same time, on a dime, they will shift to supporting a ceasefire and condemning the Trump administration for whatever the Trump administration does to continue supporting. And I mean, that's assuming that this is still going on a year from now, which, you know, would be horrifying. And yet I don't see an off ramp. You've got the Israelis talking about spending months in Rafah. And even if they, you know, the heavy activity there is finished sooner than that, I think there's still going to be a military occupation. There's still going to be some action taking place there and some deprivation of the civilians. And so, I don't think it's inconceivable this is all still going on a year from now.
No, I think that's right. I think maybe I should reframe it. Thinking about medium and long-term Democratic Party responses, you know, it took a while for the quote-unquote loss of China in the autumn of 49 and then the Korean War before the Democratic Party, you know, embraced particular policies when it came to foreign relations. And I think if he does lose, this would augur, or perhaps augur, you know, moving the Titanic, as it were, from the iceberg, a more medium-term shift. And that remains to be seen. I agree with you, though, in the actual war that's going on in the short term. If Biden wins, it'll be relatively the same. If Trump wins, I also agree it'll be relatively the same.
I think what to me... And again, without being overly morbid about this, but what's going to change Democratic Party policy on this is the gerontocracy.
Yeah, totally.
Spinning 100%. Off into the afterlife
right.
And leaving the next generation, which at that point will probably be in its 70s, to actually run the party.
Even the next generation of, septuagenarians in charge.
Right, of retirement age people.
I love this country.
Yeah, it'll take a while. You know, I wonder if I was wondering about like Blinken and Sullivan, like
Anthony Blinken, realize... the guitar player?
The guitar player.
Yeah, the blues, the blues that singer. From Gauss, star did you? Player.
Yeah. Oh, he's how is he involved here?
Well, that's a question. Is he involved? I mean, I was wondering, it's like, you know, one hope people occasionally express is like Sullivan and Blinken will go up to Biden and go, look, this is really bad. I mean, there was a poll this week saying that not just most Democrats, but a majority of the country opposes U.S. military support for the war in Gaza. 52% of Americans, numbers much higher for Democrats in this poll. Now, I will say, I concede that Biden, he has no great choices here because the old guard is strong. And that's, of course, what he viscerally identifies with himself, is the establishment kind of Israel lobby. But in one scenario, Blinken and Sullivan, I guess I'm just grasping for, you know, kind of dreams here. And in one, they kind of realize that, you know, they may go down in history as fundamentally, more than anything else, just abetting war crimes, right? Because, you know, traditionally the deal was, well, if you want to work in this town again, you can't cross Israel, right? Well, I mean, it
seems
to me...
That's less true, I think.
Well, and with these two guys, it seems to me if they have a hope of working in this town again, it's to cross Israel in a sense. I mean, if this ends the way it looks like it's going to end, with Biden's handling of this a complete disgrace, and this thought of as a humanitarian disaster that the U.S. could have done much more to curtail, and Blinken and Sullivan were the guys, I don't think there's going to be a future Democratic administration that wants them to work in it. And it seems to me slightly more likely that the Biden policy could be so discredited that they'd have a better chance of working in this town again if they resigned in protest. And I'm really not kidding. One can imagine a future Democratic administration in which that gets you a job. I mean, maybe I'm being too optimistic here.
Well, I think they'll make do with their Raytheon board membership, right? I mean, this is the problem.
Like, yeah, that, I mean they'll go back to places like West Exec, right? Or
right.
Corporate boards.
Well, if that's all they want, sure, but...
Yeah. They could go to Netflix like President Obama.
And they'll get, I mean, I'm sure they'll get, you know, chances to be... guest faculty somewhere and have a nice, cushy,
various Ivy League universities. I mean, it's interesting. People have done this comparison post-Vietnam and post-Iraq, but after Vietnam, there was actually a social cost. The one that I always point to is that Walt Rostow wasn't able to go back to MIT. He was exiled to UT Austin. Didn't really happen, though, with Iraq, right? So that means, I think, again, what's the difference is that there were masses of Americans dying in Vietnam and there weren't masses of Americans dying in Iraq. And so you might just have a transformation in the consequences of people supporting disastrous American wars, just because flat out fewer Americans are or perceive themselves to be directly affected. Big change from the Vietnam era in the 70s. You know, we didn't get the post-Iraq church hearings. Why not? It's kind of strange we didn't. And so something has changed, obviously.
I mean, there were little things with Iraq. Like Don Rumsfeld was a Princeton graduate. Traditionally, if somebody becomes Secretary of Defense and they went to your college, you at least have them back to give a talk, right? And probably you tell them that if they'd like a job at the public policy school, which was then called the Woodrow Wilson School, they can have one. He did not set foot on that campus, except maybe he showed up for reunions or something. So there were little things. But look, obviously you're right. And, you know, this is one problem now, I think, is that people like Jeffrey Goldberg, who did as much as any one journalist probably to get us into the Iraq War, were they tarred for life? No, there was the inevitable ascent of power, and now he's editor in chief of the Atlantic. Now it's, by the way, a comment on something that even the Atlantic recently had some piece severely critiquing the U.S. policy on Israel. So that's interesting, but no, your larger point is right, that it takes a lot for there to be any kind of house cleaning or accounting in the wake of a foreign policy disaster.
Because they're all guilty, right? I mean, like, ultimately, if you really wanted to, any presidential administration, you'd be able to find something basically since the beginning of U.S. history, but especially since the 1945, the ascent to hegemony, right? So they can't really do it. They can't really hold anyone accountable because then they're putting a target on their back. At least that's the way I view it. It's right. Just like, this is the wages of empire. This is what happens when you run a global hegemonic empire. And so you can't really go after anyone because then they'll go after you and it'll never end. Not I'm saying that's right. That's just what I'm saying, how they perceive it.
See, I don't know that grand strategy plays as big a role as just short-term political incentives, and that's why—
No, it doesn't. It's short-term political incentives are far more important, but they're all primacists, right? The grand strategy is basically the same, but when you're looking at, like, within that larger structure of we're going to rule the world, you're 100%. I just published an edited volume about this very question, Rethinking U.S. World Power, which shows how it's mostly domestic political processes that shape U.S. foreign relations, at least to a significant degree.
And if you take out a second mortgage on your house, you can pick a copy up today.
Is it pricey, Danny? The volume you edited, how much does it cost?
$160.
Okay. Well, listen, I think I'll wait for the paperback.
Or $150.
Or why don't you just do a long podcast about it? Maybe I'll spend a walk kind of absorbing
academic publishing. That's a whole topic we could do.
Yeah,
it's that industry. What an industry!
So at some point, I don't know if we're there yet, the paywall shows up. When we do these joint podcasts, is it that time or what? Who's the timekeeper here?
I think you are, Bob. We follow in your footsteps.
That's a lot of responsibility. Okay, let's wait like 3 more minutes then before we do that. And for starters, we can explain that you can, once the paywall does show up, you can listen to the rest, watch the rest by being a paid subscriber to either American Prestige or the Non-Zero newsletter. And by the way, if you're a paid subscriber either, you can get a 20% discount on the subscription to the other, the paid subscription to the other. Is that true?
That's still there. We'll have a link in our the show description to your discount and vice versa, I think.
Yeah, I think the way it works at our end is we'll have a link in the show notes to the episode on Substack for this. And there, in that post, below the paywall will be the magic
below the paywall.
20% yeah. link. Yeah. But what I want to talk about when we eventually, on one side of the paywall or the other, and by the way, is that too crass a term? Someone advised me against the term like paid subscriber, like I should call them premium subscribers or members or patrons.
I don't know. That forecloses on the possibility that you could get another tier of people paying even more money and call them premium subscribers.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea.
Milk it.
Paid and really paid subscribers.
Yeah, there you go. Paid and really paid.
But what I want to... one thing I want to discuss is to get back to like micro political incentives. Talk a little more about what exactly is Joe Biden's like mental world? Like, what does he perceive out there? There really are things. There really are disincentives to do what we would like him to do and exert actual leverage on Israel. But I'd like to spell them out a little more. Because I'm not sure exactly what form they take. And maybe you guys have insight into that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly a political risk to coming out against Israel, or if he had on October 8th come out and said, this is what you get for occupying a territory
that I wouldn't expect,
75 years, or, you know, well, not 75 years, but since 1967, whatever, you know, if he had done that, there would definitely have been a big political cost to be paid in terms of donors, in terms of voters, in terms of just the general sentiment of the American public. But I don't think now, 6 months later, with everybody having watched what's gone on, that's still a risk. If he just did even the most mild thing of conditioning weapons sales or weapons transfers, which is in concert with existing U.S. law. I mean, he's breaking the law at this point by continuing to send weapons to Israel based on what we know they're doing. Mm-hmm. If he just followed the law and said, look, this is, you know, 6 months down the road, look at what's happened here. We can no longer continue to enable this. I don't think he would pay that price at this point. He would pay some price with like elite donors, but with the voters, I mean, as you say, the polling has shifted markedly over these past 6 months as people have observed what's taken place. And I don't think that's the salient thing anymore. I think the salient thing is that for Joe Biden, Israel is frozen in 1973, and he's still talking to Golda Meir about the 1973 war and Israel under attack from 3 different directions. And he still views Israel in those terms as this underdog, this beacon of democracy and, you know, shared values in a difficult region that is under constant existential threat. And that's like ingrained in him. It's not going anywhere. The thing you keep seeing in these pieces that people do about like what's really going on, like why are there no consequences, no red lines, no matter what people keep coming back to. Jonathan Geyer just did a piece at the American Prospect about this. They come back to this is Biden. This is Biden driving the bus because this is his depth of feeling for Israel and his belief that after, you know, 40 years or 50 years of being a relatively, for the Senate at least, significant figure in terms of Democratic Party foreign policy, that he knows what he knows and he doesn't need to take any advice from anybody, and he's fully capable of managing this. This is Biden. It's his mindset.
Yeah. Okay. I have something to say about that. I'm sure Danny does. I also want to talk about what a Trump foreign policy might be like, including like on this issue. But I guess it is time for the paywall to materialize.
Yeah, this is where the gossip comes in, everyone. Pay to hear our gossip.
You got to pay for the good stuff.
Yeah. So thanks, everybody. And hope to see you on the other side.